20 years ago, before the Harry Potter movies or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the movie landscape looked really different. And today, we're taking a look back.
We'll be talking about some of the movies from that year and why we think they're still relevant today. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about some of the movies from the year 2000 on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Also with us from his home studio is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
Wonderful to have you. You know, Glenn, we did a similar show about 1999. Why did we decide to do 2000?
Because looking back, it is a remarkably rich year for films, one that I had completely forgotten how deep it goes. Just to give people a sense of the year we're talking about, here are the top films of 2000. Number one, Mission Impossible 2. Number two, the film that Steven chose, which we'll keep a little inessential mystery going about that. Number three, Castaway. Number four, What Women Want.
Wow.
We were different people back then. Number five, Dinosaur, a film that does not exist, that has been scrubbed from the collective consciousness. Number six, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Number seven, Meet the Parents. Number eight, The Perfect Storm. Number nine, X-Men. 2000 was a year that a superhero film could come in ninth. And number 10, What Lies Beneath? Because sure, why not?
Sure.
And I've also created, just to give people a deeper sense of that cinematic year, kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a grouping, maybe a taxonomy, of some of the films of 2000. So let's start off with the category called Totally My Jam, which are X-Men, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Best in Show came out that year, and Batman Beyond, Return of the Joker. There's also a remarkably deep bench of queer and queer-adjacent films, Bring It On, Wonder Boys, But I'm a Cheerleader, The Cell, a film that your mother loves very much, Stephen, Broken Hearts Club, Miss Congeniality, Quills, Psycho Beach Party. There are also some shambolic fiascos, disasters like Battlefield Earth and Dungeons and Dragons, which is a terrible film we should talk about at some point. There's also the mainstream, yet quirky, like Unbreakable, Pitch Black, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Nurse Betty. There's the mainstream, but funny, The Emperor's New Groove, and hugely underrated Disney film.
Yep.
Charlie's Angels, which I could have grouped under queer and queer adjacent, but that's a discussion for another day. And then, of course, there's also a deep, deep bench of art house numbers. Remember when there were art houses? Memento, American Psycho, Dancer in the Dark, House of Mirth, Shadow of the Vampire, Chopper, The Circle. In the Mood for Love, almost chose it, couldn't find it streaming. You Can Count on Me, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, and Billy Elliot. It is a deep, deep year for movies.
Well, and Glenn, I don't think you even mentioned two of the leading Oscar contenders, both from Steven Soderbergh. You had Aaron Brockovich and Traffic.
Oh, sure, yes.
So, Steven, what did you pick? Glenn was kind of building up the suspense.
Well, it is a rare convergence of a massive box office hit and the Best Picture winner at the Oscars. I picked Gladiator. Now, Gladiator, starring Russell Crowe, is a movie I actually did not see when it came out. It was just a massive, massive blockbuster. I wasn't interested. It is a true piece of kind of old Hollywood swords and sandals, tragic epic on a grand scale. And I remember it being a gigantic hit and then it being kind of a controversial Best Picture winner. Scott Tobias had a piece in The Guardian just recently, kind of reassessing Gladiator as a movie that was a little bit diminished in its reputation by winning Best Picture. Watching it now, watching it today, the first thing I thought and kind of thought throughout the film was, of course this movie won Best Picture. This is a grand, sweeping, kind of old Hollywood movie of the variety that the Oscars are bound to naturally like. I also think it's a very, very good movie. At 2.5 hours, it absolutely flies by, which is a testament to the just the skill and the craftsmanship of Ridley Scott, who directed it. It's got Joaquin Phoenix as the treacherous Emperor Commodus. Not a super historically accurate portrayal of the events of that era, but it's extremely well made, with the exception of the fact that the battle scenes are inscrutable in a way that I actually appreciated because it's so gory. I didn't necessarily need the battle sequences to be a lot more visceral in the literal sense than they already are. I enjoyed it. I dug it. And I also had to go back and dig up, how does this not star Mel Gibson? because there is so much noble bloodletting. How could Mel Gibson have actually turned this movie down, which he did?
It's funny because I don't think I've ever actually watched this entire movie. I do remember sitting down. For some reason, I watched it with my mom. And we watched probably like 10 or 15 minutes of it. And the beginning of that movie is just a bunch of people just getting killed.
Yeah.
And I remember having that great moment that you have with people that you're really close to when you can just turn to each other and say, are you enjoying this like at all? And then if you're not, you just stop watching it because it just was clearly not for me and not for her that we just stopped.
Yeah, I remember watching this movie in theaters and coming out of it thinking that was really bloated, overlong. So I'm surprised to hear it flies by. I also remember talking with the people I went to it with how the CGI looked fakety fake, all those scenes of Rome. How does the CGI hold up?
It's funny. I think I've seen so much junky CGI over the years that it didn't really affect me. It does have those scenes that look a little bit like the establishing shots of a video game.
Sure.
I think some of the kind of more gleaming scenes in the movie do look a little bit fake, but there's enough kind of ground level stuff. Also is managing this very tricky high wire act, and I think your mileage may vary on this, where it's condemning the horror of gladiatorial bread and circuses entertainment while also totally indulging in it. So
yeah, sure.
I can understand not digging this movie. It is not really my kind of movie either, but I think it's very, very effective at what it is.
Yeah, I was not entertained. And that's like, that's the thing, right? That is the one thing in terms of cultural consciousness. That's the thing that's invaded the consciousness is the are you not entertained meme.
Yeah. All right. Glenn, what did you decide to do?
I chose Sexy Beast. Sexy Beast is a British film, the feature debut of Jonathan Glazer, who hasn't had a really prolific career. He's directed a couple other films since then, one called Birth, very strange film, and one film that I like a tremendous lot that I've talked about in the show called Under the Skin. You can rent it on Amazon Prime or on Hulu if you have the Cinemax extension. Ray Winstone plays a British safecracker who has retired to this incredibly sweet villa in Spain. He gets pulled back in for one last job. And it also stars Ian McShane and Ben Kingsley as a particularly vicious gangster. Be warned, all you Yanks, that there are some thick Cockney accents thick on the ground, so turn on that closed captioning. It is so stylish. It is so fun. If you just go by the IMDb description, you're going to think, okay, this is a dark comedy heist film, and that's its overall shape. But in reality, it is based on the acting that is going on here, it's a character study. And I think the first 15 minutes of this film should be taught in film school because so much is crammed into it. There's a lot of character work. There's a lot of foreshadowing. There's this constant stoking of dread. There's this early scene that takes place in a restaurant where the characters are together. And you can see how well Ray Winstone has adjusted to his life, his retired life, how much he loves the people and the place, and how much is at stake. Because not through exposition, not through talking, just acting, you get the sense of how one phone call from London can threaten it all. Which is a real risk, right? Because the characters spend those first 15 minutes dreading the arrival of Ben Kingsley. And when Ben Kingsley arrives, there's a lot for him to live up to, right? Because there's so much in fear of this guy. And when he shows up, he lives up to it completely. He is very steely and composed and kind of lizard-like until the moment he very much isn't. And he won a Best Supporting Actor nomination for this. And the great thing about it is that you spend so much time with those characters, which you wouldn't normally do in a movie, right? You would be like, let's get to the fireworks factory. But you spend so much time with the characters before he shows up, you notice how his mere presence changes their dynamics of how they relate to each other. Now, this film came out at a time when Guy Ritchie was making films like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. And again, from the description, you think, okay, this is a Guy Ritchie film. It's not as frenetic, it's not as shaky, it's not as self-conscious as a Guy Ritchie film, because it's clearly a first-time director, right? There's some flourishes, like dream sequences and stuff, that you're like, okay, well, that's kind of film school-y. But they're assured. Those flourishes are kind of controlled. And when you watch this film, you're like, I want to watch any film this guy directs. And it's just this constant ratcheting up of tension. And the reason I chose it, the real reason, if I'm honest, all this happens in 88 minutes. Mm. Remember when we used to make films that were 88 minutes long? It's a perfect little vicious but fun little film.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
Oh, you should, you should, you should.
Good pull. So mine is neither as big as Steven's or as kind of arty as Glenn's. It is somewhere in the middle, which is part of why I chose it. I chose the movie The Replacements with Keanu Reeves as a replacement player quarterback for the Washington Sentinels, a fictional football team.
Hey, that's a good name. They should go with that.
For real. So this film is based on the, loosely based on the 1987 NFL strike. And there had been, you know, labor unrest in the NFL before. And that year, the owners decided that they would try to put together teams of replacement players. It is true that this was both a very painful labor dispute for a lot of people, and that for these individual guys who got pulled up to be replacement players, and a lot of them in real life were, you know, people who were cut from training camp or in some cases had been playing like Canadian football or something like that. Interestingly enough, a couple of the stories from the movie are roughly based on things that really happened. There really was a guy who was brought out of being in prison and allowed to leave prison to play football. So the reason why I picked this is Keanu Reeves at his most kind of mainstream comedy leading man. He hasn't done a lot of middle of the road fat pitch comedies. There's a rom-com element because he meets a cheerleader. There's a sports underdog element for all the people in this movie, including like Jon Favreau, and Orlando Jones is really funny in this movie. Now, it's 20 years old. It is dated in some of the ways that a lot of 20-year-old movies are. I can't really tell you that it is good, but I can tell you that Keanu Reeves is incredibly charming in it in a way that, probably for good reason, he has not returned to that many times. Like, most of the work he's done has been more interesting than this, which is great for him and great for art. But boy, is he good at this kind of just like lay back and just charm the screen with your face. So good at it. Plus, you also have Gene Hackman, because he's the coach. So kind of going back to that, if you loved him in Hoosiers, he's once again the coach of these underdog guys. And so the part of the reason why I picked this is the kind of movie that I can't honestly say that the art of film has suffered terribly, because you don't see as many movies like The Replacements. But boy, I miss this kind of movie. I miss these kind of just like sports movies and rom-coms. And we've talked before about the fact that the growth of like the blockbuster versus the pure indie has kind of crowded out this center where sports movies and live action family movies and romantic comedies. This is sort of a late entry in that 90s rom-com boom. And he didn't do a lot of movies like this. He did some romantic dramas, which were hugely variable in quality. He did one called Sweet November with Charlize Theron that you don't need to see, and one called A Walk in the Clouds that you also don't need to see. You know, if you're going to watch a bunch of guys do the electric slide to I Will Survive in a movie, you're just going on the likability and amiability of it. And I do think it is a really nice moment that kind of presages how I think beloved Keanu Reeves has become in the 20 years since then. Not that he wasn't already, but this is right after The Matrix. This is sort of going back one more kind of shaggy-haired dude movie before he kind of rolled on and did a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, when I saw that you had chosen The Replacements, I thought, I have never heard of this film. And then I thought, well, wait, is it a documentary about the band? Because I am in. And then I called it up on IMDb and I saw the poster. I was like, I'm out. Nope, not for Glenn. No thanks.
Well, tell us what you think about any of these movies, Be Kind, or about other movies from the year 2000. By the way, you know, I also could have chosen Bring It On, but I've talked about Bring It On so many times that I figured I would go a little more obscure.
As have I.
Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. Best Fiends is the 5-star rated puzzle game with thousands of levels, tons of characters to collect, and fun stories to follow. The game updates monthly, so there is always a new challenge to master. Help these cute and courageous characters while you play through engaging puzzle levels anywhere and anytime. No internet required. Download on the Apple App Store or Google Play for free. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Steve and Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
The 6-episode docuseries on Netflix from 2019 called Taco Chronicles, which is exactly what it suggests. It is a lavish, beautifully shot, adds up to about 3 hours of straight up food porn slash travelogue, shot mostly in Mexico in Spanish. Each episode profiles a different kind of taco. You have al pastor, carnitas, basket tacos, carne asada, barbacoa, and like guisado stews. You are just watching incredibly delicious looking, very inexpensive food be made and consumed. Boy, we just plowed through all 6 episodes, got very, very, very hungry. It's really not much more complicated than that. I mean, it's a little bit corny. The fact that it has occasionally will have an actor narrate as the food, which is kind of silly. But I also appreciated the fact that they're not talking to self-serious chefs. They're talking to craftspeople. They're talking to farmers. They're talking to taqueros. And they're talking to very hungry eaters. If you love tacos, it was just a delightful piece of escapism that made me very, very much want to leave my home, go to Mexico, and eat food.
Oh, very good. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, if you haven't seen it already, because it was heavily promoted on Netflix a few weeks back when it first came out, Middleditch and Schwartz is a series of 3-hour-long, long-form improv comedy specials starring Thomas Middleditch of Silicon Valley and Ben Schwartz from Parks and Rec. Here's the deal. They interview a member of the audience at the top, and then they key off that interview, creating a series of characters and situations very fluidly, switching characters, and then sometimes creating so many characters that they forget the names of some of the characters they created earlier. And look, I can hear you listeners out there right now. Let me assure you, this is good improv. Watch how well they listen to the audience member at the top. You can tell from the jump this is going to be good. Watch how closely they stay engaged with each other. Watch how they strive to build out this world. And then right about the 45-minute mark, they start to close the loop and with callbacks to things established in the beginning. The energy between them is so good. And what's interesting is how different these 3 specials feel, which is what you want to see. The thing about improv, even when it's bad, is that it's a communal experience. You, the performers, the rest of the audience are there, and then it's going to be gone. So you might think that having it taped and being able to watch it again, you might worry it loses some of that energy, but it's really well directed. The camera work is very agile and follows them to where it needs to follow them, and it really helps capture it. So that's Middleditch and Schwartz on Netflix.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. So you have heard me talk about the fact that I watched a lot of Cheers. You've heard me talk about the fact that I was watching a lot of The Nanny. What I have been watching recently is a lot, and I do mean a lot, of Frasier. I don't think of myself as somebody who loves Frasier, even though I was somebody who loved Cheers. And Frasier Crane is a character who came over from Cheers. He was a psychiatrist. They ported him over to his own show. If you're not familiar, he lives in Seattle. He's a radio talk psychiatrist, has a brother who's basically just like him, but slightly shorter, and his father. When I first started watching it, it was difficult for me because he's very, very snobby. Like, I think even more than he was on Cheers as a character. He's a very, very insufferable, status-conscious snob. It's not just that he's in the wine club, it's that he wants to be, like, the cork master of the wine club. But then I realized the whole show is sort of a humiliation engine that puts that character in a grinder every week and just has something embarrassing and humiliating happen to him. But he still remains the protagonist. And I think you have to go to a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm, or as somebody pointed out to me on Twitter, Veep, to find another show that is quite so determined to just humiliate its main character over and over again. And those shows are both, Veep and Curb, are both kind of pitched in a more cynical way. Frasier is still kind of pitched like a regular sitcom of the 80s and 90s. Here's what I like about it for quarantine binging. It's the same every time. There are like 3 episodes of Frasier, and they just made them a lot of times. So you can find it on Hulu. It's a very good binge watch. Frasier, starring Kelsey Grammer. as Fraser Crane. And in the best episodes, Bebe Neuwirth as his ex-wife, Lilith. Mm-hmm. So that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now if you're not singing the Frasier theme song to yourself. And thanks to both of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, go over and subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all back here next week, where we'll be talking about the Hulu comedic drama miniseries, The Great.
Face masks have become the new normal as we continue to grapple with the ongoing pandemic. But when did we start wearing masks for our health and safety?
This week on Throughline, the origins of the N95 mask and how it became the life-saving tool it is today.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.